The Final 24 Hours of the El Faro, a new book, explores what happened. When the container ship El Faro went down in Hurricane Joaquin in October of 2015, it shocked the maritime world. 33 crew members died, four of them, including the ship's captain, Michael Davidson, were from Maine. The investigation into the disaster revealed many issues that led to its sinking, old equipment that needed replacement, staff cuts at the shipping company, and inaccurate forecasts among them. But the brunt of the blame was based squarely on Captain Davidson for his decision to plot a course so close to a hurricane. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Author Rachel Slade's new book, Into the Raging Sea, follows the last 24 hours of the El Faro's final journey. She was guided by the voice recordings of the actual conversations that took place on the ship's bridge. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It was one of the worst nautical disasters in recent memory, the sinking of the cargo ship El Faro. At the time it went down, there were so many unanswered questions. Why did the captain seem to sail directly into a hurricane? Why was no one rescued from lifeboats? How could this happen in this modern era of shipping? My guest today has written a book that addresses the mystery of that day and looks at the broader story. The book's title is Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of the El Faro. Its author, Rachel Slade, joins me in the studio. Rachel is a Boston-based journalist who splits her time between Brookline, Massachusetts, and Rockport, Maine. She's joined today by Charlie Baird, who served as second mate on El Faro just 1 week before its sinking. Rachel and Charlie, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Rachel.
Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Rachel, one of the things that really struck me reading your book is how many things went wrong. And I want to talk about all of those, or maybe not all. We don't have an hour. We only have an hour. But before that, I want to sort of back up a little bit and talk about your decision to write this book. Mm-hmm. How did you know? There are so many stories within stories. The people in this book are also interesting. The layers of issues. Did you know that at the beginning? How did you know?
That's a great question. I had no idea how complicated this story was going to be. But as soon as I started digging in, and this is before the investigation really got started, I thought, you know, there are going to be layers, and this is going to be a book. So it was very early on that I knew that there were things that I wanted to explore. So it wasn't just about the ship. It was so much about what kinds of people serve on the ships that serve us. I mean, shipping is the backbone of the global economy, and these people are out there risking their lives every day, and I wanted to make a connection with our mariners, with the people who are actually doing the work to keep that global economy moving. And, you know, they're out there. They're right offshore. I live in Boston. I live in Maine. I see the ships. I wanted to know who they were.
You know, one of the things that's so fascinating about this is that there were tapes of the conversations that happened on the bridge. Did you know that at the beginning?
Absolutely not. No, when I first got involved, it was a sunken ship, and it was devastated families, and it was mariners like Charlie Baird who were still on shore. The tapes came 9 months after the ship had sunk, and the story of recovering those tapes is amazing. And I just want to mention that this is the longest black box recording that we have ever rescued. It's 26 hours. This is unprecedented. So much information, so much dialogue to go through on that bridge.
Right. And we say tapes, but it really wasn't microchipped. I should correct myself. Sorry. Yeah. No, I was the one that said tapes. But the voices, Charlie, have you listened to those? Have you listened to, or can you not do that?
Well, I've read the transcripts, but I haven't listened to the tapes per se.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you haven't heard the voices?
No, I don't think I'd want to hear the voices.
Mm-hmm. One of you are in Rachel Slade's book, and she has you sitting at home watching the Weather Channel and worrying.
right? I had gotten home maybe a week earlier, and I'm still fresh home, so I was listening to the weather station, and all of a sudden I saw a storm pop up that had just popped up recently. And I texted the captain, Mike Davidson, to let him know about it, to see if he was aware of it, because sometimes they're so busy that they don't have time to watch television. So I at least texted him to let him know that there was something brewing in his area. And he took it from there. I just kind of did my thing and just kept watching it on television.
Mm. Rachel, and this is interesting what Charlie just said, is sometimes they're so busy they don't even know what's coming. And one of the central threads of this book is there really was not accurate, up-to-date information coming to the bridge. How can that be?
Yeah, that's actually a critical part of the story. So first of all, I mean, as Charlie said, this is a regular 3-day run back and forth to Puerto Rico. It's hectic. They load. They get underway. They get down to Puerto Rico. They unload. I mean, it's just constant movement. People are exhausted. And you can tell when you're reading the transcript of the recording how tired and exhausted the people are on the ship. It's actually very upsetting to read, because you can only imagine that they're not functioning, you know, with all pistons firing.
One of the other things that comes forward in your book, Rachel, is that the ship was not in the best of shape and needed some work and was scheduled for dry dock, serious work. You just came off that a week before. Did you have that sense, Charlie, were you on the ship, that it was in serious need of repair?
No,
You didn't.
To me, the ship was very sound.
Mm. Well, I mean, the thing to remember, and Charlie, I appreciate your saying that. I mean, the one thing that is clear is that the ships that Charlie was serving on were 40 years old. We don't have 40-year-old cars anymore on the road. I mean, they're considered antiques. Certainly, these ships were built very well, but they were 40 years old, so the technology on them was very old. The steel was old. All the moving parts were old, so they required a tremendous amount of upkeep. And, of course, Charlie and the other officers and the crew spent a lot of time just maintaining these ships to make sure that they were in operational order. And, in fact, you could no longer order parts for that ship. They were no longer made. So the guys were actually using scrapped pieces from scrapped ships to fix the engine, to fix parts. I mean, this was a desperate situation. And you know, Charlie's used to that, I think, in some way, because, I mean, that was your life. You were working on these older ships. But when you step on newer ships, those guys who work on newer ships, this would be inconceivable to them.
Okay, I'm going to back up just a little bit, because so many people in our audience know this story so well and followed it so closely in 2015, but there may be those who did not. So, Charlie, why don't you just back up and tell us about the El Faro. Rachel mentioned that it's going back and forth from Jacksonville, Florida to Puerto Rico. What are you delivering? It's a container ship. What's in those containers? How important is this ship to Florida and to Puerto Rico?
Okay, we'll start off in Jacksonville, I guess. We'd be loading in Jacksonville for 2 days. And usually when we're loading, you don't know what's in the containers. They can be shipping anything. You'll have a rough idea what they put on the manifest, but sometimes they don't include everything on the manifest or forget about certain things. We carry refrigerated cargo. You know, all the food that comes to Puerto Rico comes by ship.
Right.
You know, your cars come by ship. You know, you're not going to fly a car in. So everything that comes to Puerto Rico is by ship. And then Puerto Rico is the hub. From Puerto Rico, things get sent to the Bahamas, the smaller islands all along the Caribbean, because their ports aren't deep enough to carry a ship the El Faro side. So we'd get to port, and small little feeder ships would come to us, and they'd disseminate the cargo to the lower Antilles and wherever. But Puerto Rico was the hub.
And you and your sister ship were really, the El Faro and its sister ship were really the lifeblood in many ways for the people who lived in Puerto Rico. This is how Puerto Rico got its supplies.
Yeah, we had our company, and you had a, place, another company called Trailer Bridge. They were tugging barges, but they, instead of being a two-day run, they're like 4 days. So they were less, if they wanted fried chicken in Puerto Rico, they sent it in refrigerated cargo trucks with us because the tugging barges couldn't get it there in time and weren't equipped to carry refrigerated cargo. And you also had Crowley Maritime, which is a big company down there. So between Crowley Maritime and Tote, those are the two big companies.
And Tote is the company the El Faro was owned by. Rachel, I have a list here that I've made as I'm reading through the book, the layers of issues that that you discovered and then investigators discovered, the pressure on the captain to sail in inclement weather, the pressure on the shipping industry that possibly has too many ships for the amount of cargo carrying around the country, the pressure to make money, the inexact forecasts, the old forecasts, the cuts that had happened in staffing at Tote, the uncertainty that people on the ship felt for their jobs. I wrote just simple human fallibility that we're not perfect. The engine and the boiler were outdated. No anemometer. I mean, as you're doing your research, are you stepping back and is it taking your breath away?
When you list them like that, absolutely. I mean, there were so many things kind of working against this ship that it's kind of amazing that an accident hadn't happened before. It's amazing to hear you list all of those things because they're absolutely true, and they all worked in tandem to sink the ship. And in fact, when I was working on the book, my working title in my head was, how many bad decisions does it take to sink a ship? And the answer is, I think, in the thousands. It takes a lot of work to sink a ship, and you have enumerated at least 10.
What has happened since, I think we've covered on the news, the Coast Guard investigation, but have there been real changes? Have these kind of issues throughout the shipping industry been addressed?
So regulating shipping is very difficult. You know, we're talking about basically changing laws, and the laws are the Coast Guard's purview. They set the regulations, and then they have to carry those out. But the Coast Guard is working very closely, of course, with the shipping industry. They don't want to put too many economic or financial burdens on the shipping industry. I mean, that is the lifeblood of America, is moving things around. And so it's a delicate balance. But to address your question, the Coast Guard and the National Transportation Safety Board came up with what they called a list of recommendations. And on the Coast Guard side, I think there were like 70-some recommendations, recommended changes in the existing regulations that would make shipping safer. And I think one of the big ones, and Charlie, please back me up here, but I think one of the biggest ones is really getting these open lifeboats off of these ships. They have been illegal since hulls built after 1986. So any ship built after 1986 now has to have enclosed lifeboats. And I would argue, and I've heard it both ways, but I would argue that those mariners might have had a fighting chance if they had enclosed lifeboats on El Faro.
What do you think, Charlie?
Well, I'm not going to deny that the open lifeboats are a problem. These enclosed lifeboats are definitely going to save lives. In this particular instance, I don't think any kind of lifeboat would have saved the crew. They were in a storm of the century, and you couldn't launch the boats. If they were rocking and rolling the way they were talking about with the 30-foot seas, that you couldn't launch the boats, let alone get in the boat. It'd be a death sentence to even try and get in the boat and be bashed against the boat as they're lowering the lifeboat.
Mm. Charlie, how's your life changed since the El Faro went down?
I'm retired. I don't have any years to go back at all. But it wasn't just because of that. It was just that the company I was working for, Tote, got rid of their older ships and they got new ships. And it was time for me to go. I'm 66 years old, and I've done it for over 30 years, and it was just time to go, and I realized it, and I left. And I don't miss it.
Rachel, the company Tote that owned El Faro, is still in operation.
Yes, it is.
What has been the price that it's paid?
They were fined. It's, from my perspective, a nominal amount of money. They also settled with all of the families, $500,000. That was there's a in admiralty laws, there's a limitation of the value of the ship, which divided among all the mariners ended up being $500,000 each as a settlement fee plus some undisclosed amount. So we don't know how much each family received, but they lost somebody, so that's irreplaceable. And talk goes on. And that's how American business works, I think. I'm not saying anything against Tote. Their job is to serve their clients, and I am sure that they're being much more careful at this point.
Charlie, you're here with Rachel as she talks about her book, which I'm interpreting as is real support of her and this project to go in such depth about the loss of your friends. Why do you think it's important for people to read this?
I have not read the whole book because it just came out, but I have read sections of it, and I think it's a very accurate portrayal of what happened or what Rachel theorizes happened, because nobody really knows what happened. We can put the pieces together, but I think it's a very good portrayal.
Thanks, Charlie.
Do you think the general public, I mean, we live here in Maine where so many people are connected with the sea, but in your lifetime, do you feel as though people have an understanding of what it's all about?
Well, you're talking about big ships now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a whole different ballgame.
I mean, maybe you have a neighbor who ships out and is gone for a few months and comes back from a few months, but do you think most people really understand what that really means?
I don't think most people understand what it means at all. You're gone for a minimum 2 months. When I started out, it was 4 months. 4 months on, 4 months off. But with Tote there, near the end, it was 70 days on, 70 days off, which was great. Everybody loved that because you weren't gone so long. And it's stressful. You know, it's work. You're up all the time, especially in port. We'd get to sea and we'd relax. That's when we would rest up. But in port, we were going around the clock loading cargo, because the ship doesn't make any money sitting at the dock. When it's underway getting the cargo to the next port, that's when we're making money. That's when you can actually relax, because it's like a car on the turnpike. You put it on, you put the speed control on and sit back and steer. Well, same thing with a big ship. Once you leave port and make departure, everything's automatic. You set everything to automatic and until you get maybe 10 miles from your landing port, and then you put everything back on manual. But at sea, everything's on automatic pilot.
Mm. But I do want to add that, you know, this idea of living a life where you're 70 days off and 70 days on, you're out of touch. I mean, of course, you know, technology has improved communications, but on El Faro, there were times, and Charlie, correct me if I'm wrong, but literally days where you would be out of touch. You could email, but those emails went in batches when the captain decided to upload or download information. So, you know, if you had children, if you had a new spouse, you know, if you had an ailing parent, you're out of touch. And in some ways, you know, people like Charlie, I'd imagine that can be attractive, but it's also a burden. You're away, and that's your job. You have to be away. And so it's a special kind of person, it's a unique kind of person who decides that they'd like their life to be that way.
We do have to take a quick break. We're talking with the author of Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro, Rachel Slade. Also with a man who served as second mate on the El Faro, Charlie Baird. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Humanities Council, encouraging conversations across social, economic, and cultural boundaries statewide. MaineHumanities.org and Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com.
So what exactly happens when you become a supporter of Maine Public Radio? First of all, there's a couple of easy decisions, how much to contribute, whether it's monthly or an annual one-time gift, by phone or online, and then it happens. Public radio happens. Simply put, you make it happen. You help bring NPR and the BBC to Maine. You enable the Maine Public Radio news team to do their thing in Augusta and around the state so that we're aware of what's happening and why here in Maine. You help Maine Calling have those important and interesting daily conversations with Maine voices every day. You help Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical to each better focus on trusted news programming and great music and acquire the best programming in the public radio system for our state. You help spread the signal online and over the air to virtually the entire state, reaching every citizen for free. In short, you make public radio happen. So thanks for doing your part. Right now or on Super Thursday, May 10th, mainepublic.org or 1-800-866-1475. Thank you.
And Maine Public Television's High School Quiz Show Maine is moving into the semifinals. Tonight, Falmouth and St. Dominic of Auburn go head-to-head, answering questions about math, science, history, Maine, culture, and more. One of them will take on the winner of next week's semifinal match, Bangor versus Cape Elizabeth, for the final round. Join us for High School Quiz Show Maine this evening at 8 on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, What Happened to El Faro? Joining me, Rachel Slade, the author of the new book, Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. Also here, Charlie Baird, who served as second mate on the El Faro just a week before the disaster. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to go first to Jim, who's calling from Verona. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, I am. I appreciate the show. And I think some of the comments were spot on. I've spent a great deal of my career out at sea, and had sailed as Master Mariner for some time. I will say that the pressure on the master in situations where you're pressed, I've been in operations that are in excess of $400,000 a day, was our day rate for use of our vessel, and skirting around hurricanes or having to make tough decisions. And at times, companies have asked that I leave port with maybe only one out of four lifeboats operational. Or I've been asked to go into weather situations that were rather dire. And at that point, I had to say no. And it is a tough thing when you were down the hallway, maybe your communication or in teleconference with Houston, London, New York, and wherever else it may be at the same time. And the pressure can be phenomenal on the master to leave port. I do understand that. However, it is a responsibility of the master to make sure he does have up-to-date information, weather services on his own, and take the initiative to do so. Is available through satellite communication, and I'm disappointed that perhaps all of those tools were not either available or taken advantage of.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Jim. I mean, I have heard that from a lot of masters, and I appreciate you saying that because, you know, I found that mariners have a tendency to prefer to keep secrets from landlubbers. But now that this has happened with El Faro, people like you, Jim, Captain Jim, and others have come forward and said that is the master's job, is to balance, you know, the economic needs of the company, what people are saying in the office versus the realities of being out at sea alone, subject to the vagaries of Mother Nature. And, you know, it's two completely different ways of thinking. And a master could lose his or her job for making a wrong decision, you know, either putting the ship in jeopardy or coming into port late and costing, like you said, you know, possibly $500,000. So, I mean, I can't imagine the pressures, and it takes a very strong person to be able to say, no, we're taking the safe route.
And Rachel, in your book, you talk about the master, the captain of this ship, Michael Davidson, had been called on the carpet for making a decision to skirt a storm that didn't end up being as bad as it was forecast.
Well, we don't know if that happened, and one can only guess whether that was a factor. We do know, actually, thanks to Charlie. Charlie was on the ship, what was it, 3 or 4 weeks before. There was a tropical storm, Erica. She was rolling in, and Charlie discussed it with, well, actually, Charlie, why don't you tell the story? You're right here.
I discussed it with the Captain Davidson there. That we had a potentially serious storm coming our way, and we had alternate routes to go to Puerto Rico. One of the routes was called the Old Bahama Channel. And at the time, we had five Polish laborers and a chief engineer who were working, putting up electrical cables and piping, because the ship was going to be sent to Alaska for the Alaska run. So we had plenty of work to do, and the work that had to be done all overhead. So as a result, if you had any kind of rolling or pounding, you had 6 high-paid people that wouldn't be able to work. And the alternate route only costs 6 hours. And usually when you hit into rough seas, you got to reduce speed because you can't take that pounding. And if we had to go into the rough seas taking the pounding and nobody being able to work, it didn't make sense. So we took the alternate route to Puerto Rico via the Old Bahama Channel, and everybody could work and everybody could sleep, and there was no rolling involved, and we got there a little late, but as long as you let the shore side know ahead of time that you're going to be a little late, then they can adjust their work schedules, and everybody was happy.
Hmm. It's interesting to me, Rachel, because Captain Jim, who's called in, talks about conference calls and satellite conference calls and figuring out what to do in a storm. It does not appear that this is what happened with Alfaro. There was no one back at the company. There was no discussion going on about what they were seeing from land, what they were thinking. It seems as though Captain Davidson was really on his own.
That's right. This is what they call a milk run. It's, 3 days down, 3 days back, load, unload. It was a very typical run. This company has been doing this for decades. Nothing has ever happened. So the company was not tracking the ships, was not terribly involved in decision making, and that had worked for decades. And other shipping companies are much more involved with their ships. This company was not. They don't have to be. But from my perspective, if your whole company is built around logistics, then you should be very involved with where those ships are and how decisions are being made. Absolutely, yes, this company was not involved. Captain Davidson, at about, I think, 10 o'clock in the morning, sent, the day before the ship went down, sent an email to the shipping company saying, we've changed our course a little bit, but I think we're going to get in on time. And I'd like to take, as Charlie mentioned, the Old Bahama Channel back, which means we're going to be a little bit late. We're going to be running a little bit slower. I just want you to know. And it took literally 6 hours for anybody to respond to that email. So what Captain Jim is describing, it must have been, an international shipping company, possibly Maersk. This was not tow. Tow ran these ships, like they were trucks going from, Portland to Boston.
Jim, thank you for your call. We're going to go to Belfast and Ralph. Hi, Ralph. Go ahead.
Hello, Jennifer. In the early 80s, I sailed on the Fortaleza, which was at the time under Puerto Rico Marine Management Incorporated, which then became apparently this company that Charlie speaks of, that he worked for, TOW. At that time, I was an engineer. It was steam at that time as well. And briefly, there were a lot of problems on that particular boat. I don't believe it exists anymore.
Yeah, I think it got scrapped at Fortaleza.
As mentioned, these ships were old. And It was nothing for a chief engineer to order someone in the engine room to cut a hole in the bulkhead, which is frankly illegal, but it was done, and I did one myself, so I know. What thing I would like to, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff that I really want to get into, but what I'd like to see this book proceed to do would be to continue to address these issues, because in my mind, this accident was an accident waiting to happen, and it's been waiting to happen for 30 years since I last sailed. One other brief thing, I lost classmates in the early 80s when they investigated the loss of the ship in the Mediterranean. It was a ship that was designed to carry coal at the time, but then they converted it to grain. The bulkheads leaked, the grain swelled, and the ship sunk. That's the speculation. When they finally got around to go ahead and try and figure out who the office people were and all of that, it turned out that the company was actually a mail drop in New York. It didn't exist. So, anyway, I'm done with that, I guess.
Ralph, thanks for calling and sharing. A lot of people in this state can relate to your book.
Absolutely. I mean, Mam Maritime, you know, is a tremendous academy, and so there are a lot of mariners up here and also in Massachusetts. But yeah, what you're speaking to is absolutely correct. This was an accident waiting to happen. These ships were very old and they were vulnerable. And I wrote about that in my book. They were not actually container ships, the sister ships that we're talking about, but specifically El Faro was not designed as a container ship. She was not designed to carry containers, which means she had a very different profile, her hull. She was slim. And she had narrow hips, and she was designed for speed, and she was designed for trailers to roll on and go down into her massive holds. And that meant she was designed basically to carry the weight low. When containerization really took over the world in the mid-70s and onward, and now we have these mega ships that can carry like 20,000 containers at one time, when containerization took over, the El Faro was modified. Now she's carrying weight differently. So she's got containers up high. She's got trailers down below, but she still has that hull profile that's quite narrow. And so as mariners will say, she, and again, Charlie, you can let me know if I'm incorrect here, but she was tender, which means that she was very responsive, let's say, to changes in wind and waves and steering changes, whereas these large container ships now are actually quite fat, if you will, and they have a nub of a keel. So they're not these narrow, sleek boats. They're kind of fat, chubby, and much more stable.
And don't roll nearly as much. Ralph, thanks so much for your call. I have an email from John. Did Rachel interview anybody who worked for Tote Maritime, the ship owner, or Tote Services, the ship operator, prior to writing the book? And also, did Rachel interview any seafarers that sail for other countries who typically work under contracts of 8 months at a time or more? Mm.
Great question. Okay, so first of all, the answer about Tote is I didn't have to. So there were three rounds of hearings, 2 weeks each, and a whole litany of Tote executives and officers and office staff testified under oath in front of the Marine Board. So there was just massive amounts of testimony there, and I directly quote from them in the book so that readers can clearly understand their position and their behavior during and after the accident. And I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the second. Oh, and then in terms of international shipping, yes, actually, I took a container ship from Rome to Baltimore this summer. So I spent 12 days at sea crossing the Atlantic. I got to spend a lot of time actually with the Philippine crew. And yes, they're at sea for 8 months. They never ever see their family, and they're just sending that money back, and I can't imagine what that's like. Of course, the officers were mostly Italian, and they had a much more regular lifestyle. I mean, for a mariner, a regular lifestyle. But yes, I mean, these crews, especially international crews, life can be incredibly brutal, but they're getting paid relatively speaking, pretty well. So these are good jobs.
We're talking about the book Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. Its author, Rachel Slade, is here. Charlie Baird is with us as well. He served on El Faro as second mate. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco. And Taggart Construction in Freeport, working to create healthy homes that respect the environment since 1994. TagCon.com.
Many people recognize that a free press, independent journalism, adds to a properly functioning democracy. Hi, Erwin Gratz here, host of Morning Edition. Public radio is part of that equation. You know that. That's why you listen. You trust this service. You count on it. That's why public radio exists and will continue to thrive. And your support is another part of the equation. We're non-commercial. Our crowdsource is you. Our one-day Super Thursday campaign is May 10th, but you can contribute in support of public radio right now at 1-800-866-1475 or go to mainepublic.org. And thanks for doing your part.
On the next Speaking in Maine, the looming deadline of the Iran deal.
Instead of ending up in war, the United States may end up being forced to come to the table and recognize that Iran is a power in the region.
Trita Parsi is the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. He addresses the history and outlook of the deal with the World Affairs Council of Maine. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine this afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what we know about the 2015 sinking of the container ship El Faro, one of the worst maritime disasters in recent history. My guest, Rachel Slade, she's a Boston-based journalist, and we're discussing her book, Into the Raging Sea. She's joined by Charlie Baird, who served on El Faro as second mate. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Jeannie. She writes, I can't help but be struck by the similarities in decision-making by the captains of the three sunken vessels, El Faro, Bounty, and Raw Faith. And Jean says she's an ex-boat person, USCG 100-ton license. Mm.
So the Bounty was actually a ship built for the movie Mutiny on the Bounty. And so it was a sailing ship. And she sailed out of Mystic, Connecticut during Hurricane Sandy. And the captain's idea was that he was going to run the storm. He was going to pull far enough away from everything and be way out at sea and thought that he would be okay. And that ship went down. It's an incredible story. Took the captain with her and actually a woman, a crew member with her, but other folks were saved. I think, and I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the other
Raw
ship.
Faith.
Raw Faith. But I will definitely look that up when I get to my Google machine. But I think in both cases, certainly there was hubris involved, that we can handle this. The ship can handle this. We are a solid crew. We're a brave crew. We're going to be okay. And I think part of that decision-making is just that this had not happened. This was, in their lifetimes, almost unprecedented. And you just never think that you're going to be the one. You never think that you're going to be on that one ship that goes down. So I think that's part of it. But I also just think that the awesomeness of Mother Nature cannot be comprehended until you find yourself right in the middle of it. And men and women who have been caught in hurricanes will never do that again. And actually on the ship, you know, the conversation on the bridge that was captured by the black box, the officers are talking among themselves about storms that they've been in before and talking about the fear, the horror, the awesomeness of being in a storm. It's something that you know, on the one hand, when I was writing this, I was like, I want to experience that. But on the other hand, that's death. That's, you're at death's door. And some people have lived to tell the tale. Charlie, have you been in weather like that?
Well, we've been in weather like that many times, but we do our best to avoid it. We wouldn't want to put ourselves or our crew through the worst of it, because you're damaging, you don't want to damage the cargo, because your job is the safety of the ship, the crew, and your cargo. You put yourself into that kind of weather, you're going to damage the cargo, you're going to have a crew that hasn't slept in a day or two, and you're going to take damage to the ship. I've seen damage many times. Steel will bend with a huge wave breaking on board.
Mm. Kim on Facebook writes, are there any procedures that might put in place for a crew member or members to override a captain's decision? Rachel,
yes.
Many, the first, second, third mate on this ship, was captured by the voice recorder, were very uncomfortable with the captain's decision to set the course that he did.
So that's an excellent, excellent question. So there was a major airline accident in the 1970s or 80s. That the National Transportation Safety Board looked at very carefully. And it turned out that the major problem there was that the pilot was not listening to the co-pilot. And since that time, because these are passengers, these are commercial airlines, they put into place management training so that they were trained to communicate in a way that they would listen to people under them. Now, remember that maritime is also, you know, it has a very strong hierarchy. It's kind of quasi-military in that respect. So you need to respect authority. And, by the way, don't forget that mutiny was punishable by death until, you know, the 20th century. So mutiny is very, very, very serious. Unfortunately, maritime, from a management training perspective, from what I understand, from what I've learned, is behind. They don't have these kinds of bridge resource management training programs in the same way that they do with commercial airlines and other industries where you have life or death decisions and it's very important to listen to your crew. So what we had were officers who could see the future, who saw what was happening, who tried to warn the captain using every resource they could, cajoling, humor, flat out, you know, alarm, trying to convince the captain that they were heading for something big. And unfortunately, in that case, it was impossible to move him. But I agree that the maritime community should take cues from the commercial airline community and other industries and make sure that there's a system for listening to folks on the boat, that it's not insubordination if somebody challenges the captain. And Charlie, you might have some thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, well, we took bridge resource management where it mostly involves communication between your captain, your chief mate, second mate, and third mate. However, the final decision is always up to the captain. And once he's made his decision, there's no way that I know of that would change that decision. On board ship, the captain is God. And if he makes that decision, there's just no way you can defer from it. He made his decision, and then you just deal with it. And that's the way we were trained in school, and that's the way we were trained on the job.
We'll go to Bob, who's calling from Eastport. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi. I've sailed Master 14 years, and I got to say, most of the companies that I work for were very good about providing the information we needed and listening to what we wanted to do. But I once had a company that made a question with my decisions to slow a ship down in some heavy weather. And I asked them, you know, they were in the Chase Manhattan Plaza in New York, and I, up, you know, 30th floor or higher. And I asked them, is your Chase Manhattan rolling 30 or 40 degrees in each direction every 10 or 15 seconds? And they never asked me again. They left me alone after that. So, you know, they would listen. But it's a tough position to be in as master to make those decisions.
Is this Bob Peacock?
Yes, it
Hi,
is.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling in today and sharing. We'll move on to Fred, who's calling from Tenants Harbor. Hi, Fred. Go ahead.
Hi. Hey, great program. Thank you. Thank you. I just wanted to add something I thought was really great. A book by Mr. William Langwisch, I believe that's how it's pronounced. It's called The Outlaw Sea. And what an eye-opener about the, I think he said on average, 80,000 giant ships cruising around the planet at one time. I'm not sure of that number, but it's an awful lot. And it adds to the picture, as well as this book, which I plan to get, of what it takes for all the cars and all the stuff that gets shipped all over the planet.
Sure. Thank you, Fred. And this is what you're talking about at the very beginning, Rachel, that this is the saga of one ship that ended in a terrible disaster, but that it's really the saga of the backbone of the modern world.
Absolutely. That's correct.
Yeah. So, Fred, thank you so much for calling in. I want to go to a message here. This is Doug on Facebook. Two quotes, and I think he's quoting from you from the beginning of the program, Rachel. The crew was exhausted, and Tote's job is to serve its clients. What about Tote's responsibility to the safety of its crew? This seems to be the unspoken issue here.
Please read my book. Do you want to speak about that, Charlie? I don't want to put you on the spot.
No, I can address it. Our most stressful time would be when we were loading and discharging. That's when we're up around the clock. And if you did get to bed, you're hearing containers banging onto the deck and waking you up, shaking the ship. When we got to sea, that's when we all relaxed. I think I said this before. Yeah, we put the ship in speed control and everybody goes to bed. Then you just sit your watches and everybody's happy. But in port, we're working. And when we leave port, all we want to do is go to bed.
But one thing that I do want to mention, Charlie, and I think you've told me about this before, is that they used to have a mate who helped with the loading and during the loading and unloading. Is that correct? So they actually lost a fourth mate at some point?
Yes. It came to a point where everybody was getting so tired out and they'd be going over their hours. Like, I'm sure you've heard of that where your plane hasn't been allowed to take off because the crew was all over hours. Well, the same thing with us. We'd go over our hours. So to get over that, they were sending in an extra mate to help with the loading and discharging so that the regular crew could get some rest.
But then they stopped doing that.
Sometimes they couldn't get an extra mate, so we had to work extra time. And we would go over our hours many times, but you had to do what you had to do.
I mean, this is the thing. The economics demand that, you know, you cut wherever you can. And what I found, it's in my book and it's quite clear, is that this company was going through what they call restructuring, and they let go of a lot of probably, I would argue, critical staff. And so they got to such a small number of staff that there was very little bandwidth to be able to do the basic tasks that need to get done. And that's why I would argue that this was an accident waiting to happen.
In your epilogue, Rachel, of the book, and please, people, don't not buy the book because I'm talking to you about this, but you talk about the reality today and what the federal government is doing, and you're looking at proposed budget cuts to NOAA, which is the agency that oversees the National Weather Service and hurricane forecasting, and cuts to the Coast Guard, which, is the agency in charge of making sure ships are safe. You don't see attention to the shipping industry and things that could support it going in the right direction.
This is what really worries me. You need to know, we all need to know, that developing countries in Asia, China, Thailand, Korea, they heavily subsidize their shipping industry. They throw a huge amount of money to port building, to shipbuilding, and to transporting goods, because they understand that moving goods from their countries to the United States, to Europe, is how they finance their world. And it's the same here. And so I find it appalling that we just forget about our ships and we forget about our mariners. And we assume that everything is just going to be okay, while these other countries, which are, and by the way, they have major trade imbalances with us now. You know, we're importing so much from those countries now. And I would argue in part because their shipping industry is so heavily subsidized at this point.
We just have a couple minutes left in the program. And Charlie, since you were nice enough to come here with Rachel today, I wanted to know if you wanted to say anything about your former crewmates who were lost, Jeremy or Daniel or anybody else, how you'd like them to be remembered.
Well, they were all professionals, and I sailed with them all for many years and really never had an argument with any of them. They were great people. It's just a sad ending, very sad ending. And thanks be to God that, you know, I got off 10 days before. If I hadn't, I'd be one of those 33, without a doubt.
Rachel, do you feel as though you've gotten to know the people whose voices you heard on those tapes?
As much as anybody could. I met with their families. I spent time with Charlie. I spent time with other mariners who knew them. Not everybody would speak to me, but those who did were very helpful. And reading the words of these good, you know, hardworking Americans on transcript, it created an intimacy I would not have had otherwise. You know, when you read the transcript, and I hope when you read my book, you can't help but start to identify with these folks. They're just like you and me. They saw what was coming. They were scared. They were professional. They were hopeful. They tried. And so many times when I was writing this, I said to myself, what would I have done? And honestly, I don't know.
Well, thank you so much for being here. That's Rachel Slade. She's a Boston-based journalist. Her new book is Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. Charlie Baird came with her today. Charlie served as second mate on the El Faro and had been on the run before, right? The run right before the disaster.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our archives at mainecalling.org. Today's program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, why vinyl record sales are on the rise. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.